Welcome all of you at het nieuwe instituut. Welcome at the Thursday Night Live and more particularly welcome at the Bot Club. My name is Klaas Kuitenbrouwer. I'm researcher in digital culture in het nieuwe instituut. And I put together these Bot Clubs, which are programs about algorithmic culture, which you might kind of catchphrase as the entanglement of our society with algorithmic processes. So we look at the political, social, aesthetic, even philosophical dimensions of this entanglement, basically. And tonight, we are turning our curious gaze towards the highly dynamic field of legal tech. In more general terms, the various attempts to merge legal code with the code of programmers, posing in all different ways the question, to what extent can the spirit of the law be captured in the letter of computer code? We have two brilliant speakers, Matthias Dobbelaren-Welvaart and Max Hampshire. Matthias, they both work in a different, you might say, intensely debated field of technology. Matthias is more the expert on AI and machine learning, and his firm, De Juriste, develops legal tech in that area. Max Hampshire works in the field of the blockchain and the Ethereum-facilitated smart contracts. And his collective, I should say, firm is probably not the right... We'll figure out about that. Is operating in this field. So I would first like to ask Matthias on the stage. Matthias Dobbelaren-Welvaart is founder and managing partner of De Juristen, De Jurists Europe. With offices in Ghent, Brussels, Amsterdam, Paris, and Ghent, Brussels, Amsterdam, Paris, and London. He specializes in online privacy and freedom of speech. He studied law at the University of Ghent, obtained a postgraduate in ICT and media law at the University of Leuven. He's professor at the Erasmus Hogeschool Brabant, where he teaches on copyright and media rights, and he regularly lectures related to privacy, legal tech, and machine learning, as he will do tonight. And De Juriste has developed the legal bot Lee and Ellie, which will be featuring centrally in tonight's talk. And Matthias will tell us all about it.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. Brilliant speaker, no stress.
Yeah.
I have a bit of a migraine, so if I talk gibberish, just let me know. It's a lovely Thursday evening, and you chose to come to hear a legal guy speaking. You must be one of the special ones. But thank you so much for joining me. Is there anyone with a legal background here? Few people, so I have to be a little more strict on what I'm going to say. The legal field is very, very boring. And it's, since 100 or 200 years, not so much has changed in the daily practice of lawyers. So about the jurists, not so much. We are a legal agency. We are not lawyers. I already got an introduction. We have a few offices also in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam. I'm from Belgium, which is essentially a very small country with a very large problem because nothing really works in my country. The Netherlands is a bit more efficient at that. So, history. A lot of lawyers and traditional jurists do not really believe that AI or machine learning will impact their business. And that's the same mistake they keep making over and over and over again. 10 years ago, they thought, we don't really need a website. If we have a golden plate at our door saying advocaat or lawyer, then we're going to make it. In the past 10 years, they have been spending a lot of money on branding, on website design, and so on. So they caught up. But now, again, they're making the same mistake because lawyers in general, they believe that what they are doing is very, very special and that a machine can never replace them. I beg to differ, which doesn't make me a big friend with the lawyers in Belgium. Disruptive, I'm not wearing white sneakers. Disruption is not about being hip. We see some legal practices building legal tools just for the PR. You know, just to say, hey, look, we are also innovative. Even our own chatbot, I mean, it's a great PR, but it actually has to bring value to the people who are using it, whether that be businesses or consumers. So you have to bring value to the market. Who agrees with this slide? everyone except the legal people, I think, who think law is boring, yet you showed up. Only two people, actually. I think law is very, very boring. I have no love for the law as such. However, I think the legal world can be very interesting. It's only that the law is brought to you in the same way that our grandparents treated law. It's not very transparent. I don't know if anyone on the bedside has a legal codex to fall asleep, but it's not very readable. It's not exciting to read the law. And it's a bit a shame because law is everywhere around us. If you're eating, then the European Commission already decided which foods can be important. If you're having sex, for example, you better make sure that the other person is consenting. It's also the law. Law is everywhere around us. And yet we don't really care about it. And that's a shame. So 2018, I just changed the slide yesterday from 2017 to 2018. But I will believe that this is the year of AI and machine learning, and it will revolutionize old-fashioned industries. The question is why? Old-fashioned industries have a lot of historical data. AI is as stupid as you want it to be. What I'm trying to say is, no problem, just join us. Welcome. AI can be very, very smart, but it can be very, very stupid at the same time, and it all depends on the data. So if you are working in a new sector, in a new industry, you don't have a lot of data to count on. But lawyers and law offices, they have an enormous amount of data. Value optimization, lawyers are very good in one thing, and that is sending invoices. They love to send invoices. So they already try to reduce costs everywhere. You wouldn't say if you actually get your invoice from the law office or the legal office, but they've been cutting costs since ever. So they know how to do it, and the next thing might be machine learning. Make no mistake, AI is not something new. I mean, it dates back to the 50s or the 60s with great optimism about AI. AI was going to change the world, followed by an AI winter, where investments were drawn back and everyone was depressed because the computers couldn't match up with the philosophical ideas of AI. Nowadays, no problem. Nowadays, it's different. Our computers are much, much stronger. But AI is already everywhere. In the bank apps that you use, in your favorite Snapchat filter, Snapchat release an update, which is not very much loved by the youngsters. To everywhere, to Spotify. Great example is Spotify. It started out as a database with music, and now it's basically a music butler, showing you lists that you might like, the daily mixes, the weekly mixes, and so on. So AI is everywhere. Another legal topic, I'm not going to go too deep in it, is of course the ethics around AI. The European Commission is working very hard around the legal issues on AI, but the first concern for Europe is to build a kill switch in robots because they're going to kill us all, which is, of course, ridiculous because, the real problem is if you implement AI in our society, what are we going to do with the jobs that replaces it? But what if your Tesla is a silent killer? I'm going to ask you a question. Imagine you have a Tesla, so that also imagine that you're rich, and you have a setting in your car. And you have to choose whether the Tesla drives to a tree to save someone or you drive over that person. If that person is an old lady, who would sacrifice their life for that old lady? Two people. And if it's a child, like a toddler, a cute little girl, how many people would then sacrifice their life? You see? We're all assholes. No, that's not true. But that will be the big debate. Will lawyers be replaced by computers? Maybe. Here are three articles that prove me right. If you do a Google search, you will also find three that prove me wrong. It says lawyers could be the next profession to be replaced by computers. Exciting. Junior lawyers, they have the most to fear. They're also the ones that really don't like me. The older lawyers, they think it's fantastic because they already made their money and they are very curious about this technology because it can save money. Technology is already being deployed. Ross, we're going to talk about it later, is already hired by some of the most top-tier law firms in the world. So how to prepare for the legal future is quickly. the top five digital transformation trends in legal. So let's say the legal industry, it says here, was slow to adopt. It's still slow to adopt, so make no mistake. It's really not an innovative sector. But what we see on the market today, first of all, it's machine learning. Machine learning and artificial intelligence are usually kept separate, but it has huge influence on each other. It's, of course, that it's an enormous amount of data, boxes of client history, briefings, report, and so on. And it's like finding a needle in a haystack. When you're a junior lawyer, you're sent to the library for hours and hours and hours to find that certain text or that certain decision from the court. With machine learning, you could do it as quickly in a matter of seconds. Robot lawyers, there's one, a very popular one. It's Do Not Pay. It's very popular in the UK. If you have a fine, a traffic fine, you can serve to Do Not Pay. It's rudimentary at first, but it's really exponentially growing. And Do Not Pay actually overturned more than 3 million in parking tickets in the first few months, and it's free. In Belgium, we've launched the very first B2B, business-to-business AI legal robot, as far as we are aware of, Lee & Ali. So mobility, lawyers are still driving everywhere. In Belgium, you have to drive to the court and manually give to the, not the judge, but the secretary, whatever you're going to plead, your case. The only thing a little bit acceptable in Belgium is getting it by fax. Fax. Not email, it's very dangerous email, we're not doing that, but fax or giving it. So mobility will be a big issue or a big turnover for lawyers. Performance tracking, I'm going to skip that one, that's more internal, how to improve the assets. Online legal services, LegalZoom is a very big one. Rocket Lawyer is also a big one, even here in the Netherlands. If businesses are not using these services for creating an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, they're probably paying too much. That's the case, period. And of course, these systems, they have so much data, on and on and on, that they will also use it in chatbots, which is, if I'm correct, the next thing. So what's already on the market? Legal tech startups are on the rise, but it's more coming from the USA and outside of Europe. Because Europe is very fragmented, the European Union likes to believe that it's harmonized, but in every country there are different exceptions. So ROS, we already talked about it, is the Canadian legal AI. It's with support from IBM, which is a gigantic firm, but it's only usable by top-tier law firms at the moment. So what they're doing, ROS, it's a very smart business model. They're making friends with the top-tier lawyers. They say, you can have it, but you have to pay for it. And they are training the robot, so it gets better and better and better. So what will happen after a few years? They will say, thank you so much for your input, but now we are shifting from this small legal market to a huge consumer and business market. That's not on the website, and I'm pretty sure the lawyers don't really understand it because they're very proud. Avo is another online legal service marketplace. LegalZoom is estimated to be worth $425 million. But you see there, some lawyers saw it as a threat, and investigations were launched against us. That's the typical reaction of the classic legal sector. Rocket Lawyer is backed by Google Ventures, and if anything is backed by Google, you know that it's going to be big. It's also in the Netherlands today, not in Belgium. You have to ask yourself, though, where's the real AI in all of this? Well, I made a statement in the Belgian press when we launched Lee & Ali in September last year. And I said, 80% of all lawyers will be obsolete in 2025. Now, if you want to be the enemy of lawyers, this is a thing you need to say on the radio or on television, because they were all like furious. Do I actually believe that 80% of lawyers are going to just magically disappear? No. What I do believe, however, is that 80% of the work that lawyers do will be automated by AI or machine learning in 2025. Because what a lawyer does is sometimes very repetitive. Making contracts, there's only small changes often that needs to be made, so you can automate really a lot. Of course, I'm still a jurist. I didn't wear a suit today because this is a creative tech crowd. I actually studied IT too, but people still look at me like, you're a jurist. So one has to wonder, is the real innovation coming from guys like me? or is it coming from outside the legal sector? If you take a look at Uber, it was founded by Kalanick because he paid up to $800 for hiring a private driver, and he thought that was way too expensive. Uber's here in Rotterdam too. If I'm correct, in Belgium, not really. It was once in Brussels, but then our taxi started to strike, and we are very protective. But he wasn't a taxi driver. Now, let's take another example. So after founding Deliveroo, he was actually a former investor analyst in a top-tier firm. What he did was driving around his scooter for 6 months, delivering pizzas and food to people. He quit his job. He worked at the London hedge fund, which actually just means having a lot of money. And at one point, he was bringing a pizza to his old manager there. And that old manager thought, dude, what happened to you? You were a successful analyst, and now you're here on your scooter with your pizza. He had no time to reply, so he just, hey, here's the pizza, and left. And now Deliveroo is a gigantic success, apart from the labor contracts with their couriers. It's always legal that... So, Spotify is another example. This guy was actually 14 when he founded his first company, acquired by eBay, was rich enough, never had to work a day in his life, but he actually founded Spotify, which we all love and use. This is a very strange clicker. So, the question is, will the real legal tech startup stand up? Because the CEO of Uber was never a taxi driver, the CEO of Deliveroo never a cook, the CEO of Spotify never a musician, and the CEO of Booking.com never a hotel owner. So most of you are non-legal people, but if you're inspired to do something better with the law, and I hope you do, then don't feel frightened by this field. It's not because you're not a jurist or a lawyer that you can't do anything with legal tech. It is said that legal technology will make it easier for small players to compete with the big law firms that you all know. I'm not quite sure, because these big law firms have the money and the funding. We actually also got funding. Because we're not a law firm, we can get external funding. We got 1 million from an ICT hedge fund in Belgium to build this robot, because it's very expensive at the time to build AI robots. So I'm not quite sure if that is going to be the case. What I see is that more and more big law firms will even take a step ahead, while the small law firms perhaps will take a step back. Legal design, buzzword alert. Some of you are designers, I think. Who's in design? Oh, there are great opportunities for you. Why is that? Because legal contracts are appalling. It's really appalling. I mean, it's never been created by someone with a design eye. I studied IT, did a little bit of design too. That doesn't make me a designer at all. But contracts could be beautiful. It could be clearly written. Key points could come out beautifully visually. It's just not happening. You get 36 pages of unreadable Times New Roman, point 12, and it's all in just one mass text. So that should be a lot better. And now legal design is buzzing around in our world. And there's a recommended read on Medium. Productize. So you should actually... What's happening is that legal services get productized. The problem is it gets productized in very small things right now, which isn't really good for the market. One of these things is chat. So what we did with our legal agency a year and a half ago was turning to chat. You can reach us with WhatsApp, Telegram, Slack, web chat, and it actually replaced like 80% of emails and phone calls within our company. Of course, you also get an enormous amount of stupid chats from school children who are doing research, and they're like, help me make my task, which is not the point, but it's actually making yourself more reachable to clients. Of course, this requires some programming that is obviously missing in small or medium-sized firms. Legal chatbots, however, because with just web chat or Telegram chat, it's still another human on the line. Chatbots is one step further. Why is it a revolution, a chatbot? Our firm hourly rate is 225 euro per hour. We specialize in IT and IP law. This, the chatbot we've built, is going to be 99 euro per month. You can do the math, right? If a client comes with us for a document, you can count on 3,000, 4,000 euro. So it's going to be, when it hits the market for real, it's going to be a real change. But it's very time-consuming to do it now because someone has to write the question and the answers. So most legal things can be automated. Of course, why is it not happening really today in this market? Because the client, certainly in Belgium, that's where we are beta testing, Amsterdam, Netherlands and France are the next, and the United Kingdom, they still really like the human touch. When you go to a lawyer, you want to trust this guy or this woman, and with a chatbot, there's really no one on the other line. It's just a program. And it will take years for most people and even businesses to get used to it. But the real change will be when the client stops paying. When the client says, no more. I don't spend 1,000 or 2,000, 3,000 euro on a document. I won't pay you 2,000 euro to register my trademark, and so on. In Belgium, if you start up a company, I don't know the situation in the Netherlands, but you have to go through a notary, right? It's a very expensive guy. It's like 1,500 or 2,000 euro. He just puts a stamp on a document, and that's 1,500 euro. So easy money, I should have been a notary, but it's not very future-proof, that business model. Of course, the law protects the lawyers in a sense that it's protectionism. In France, for example, if you're not a lawyer, gezondheid, forgot in English. If you're not a lawyer, then you can't give legal advice. So you may have studied 5 years in university, but you have to be admitted to the bar. In the United States, the same. The Netherlands, Belgium, and the UK, they have a more open market, but you have to question for how much longer. Lawyers are really feeling the pressure, and they might turn to the parliament and say, well, it's kind of enough with these guys. You know, we want to have a monopoly on giving legal advice. And then my business is over, which is a bad thing, but it's worse for legal evolution, legal technical evolution. So for many, it's time to wake up. Very short, because we're going to talk about it later, I think. 3-4 minutes left. Perfect. We created, who's using Slack? Anyone? Yes. Slack is a wonderful tool. Now my colleagues, who are mostly in an open shared workspace, they're not talking anymore to each other which sandwich they want over lunch. They're just all doing it in Slack. It's very annoying, but it's also a very useful tool because it replaced internal email. What we did was build Spectre. It's, it's like a plugin which you can put in your Slack. Well, it's an in-house legal counsel for free. And why we did it for free, not because we are so generous, but because we learned a lot about how non-legal people ask questions. Because that's the most difficult thing. We are legal people. We write, think, speak in a certain way that normal people don't. So we had to have the data, how they ask questions, in order to make the chatbot, which is the next thing. So the real value of Spectre is obtaining rich data. Spectre still exists. You can still add them in your Slack. And what it basically does, invisibly, it puts you through with one of our humans. So with the knowledge of Spectre, we built something different. First AI legal robot in Europe. Great. I'm going to give you one tip. It's not always good to be the first. You should be the best. Lee and Ali from Legally and also Artificial Intelligence, Legal and Artificial, oh, what a brand. I have to stay with the computer. I like to walk around, but tonight it's very dangerous. Yes. So we got the press because, in fact, we're still learning from businesses their reactions. But if there's one thing we learned, journalists, they love everything with AI. If you build something and you just put AI on it, you're going to get into the newspaper. Okay, maybe I overdid it.
Would this be allowed in Germany?
It's a good question. We are researching it. It would be allowed, but the support would have to come from a lawyer, from a lawyer office. Yeah. And it's even in Germany, you have cantons, and it's also restricted in that way. So we're still researching, which makes our investors really pissed. But good. We got a Belgian Legal Tech Award, which wasn't really hard to win because Belgium is not at all innovative. So, hello, Lianali. So the price for the test version is 35 euro per month. It's pocket change, no? So, it's Dutch. I want to hire someone. You see like a Google-esque interface. Now I'm going to show you the real problem with it right now. If you ask something, you have to choose the container, the legal field. The robot will make a suggestion. But why is that? Because we tested first with 100 questions and answers, and it worked brilliant. Then we put in 800-900 questions and answers, and the bot didn't work anymore. It was terrible. So what we had to do is create technical containers, which are fields of law. But this is very annoying for the user, because every time you ask something, you have to click, and it halts the real chat experience. So that's something that we really have to fix. So you want to hire someone. We have a human help desk available 7/7. That means Saturday and Sunday too. To great enthusiasm from my colleagues, they're very happy with this. But it's from 8 in the morning to 10 in the evening. And why we did it? Because people don't trust robots yet. So you have to have the human help desk in there to convince them. Some more screenshots. How does it work? Well, you also have relevant questions. You can always give feedback. We don't allow active feedback. It works with NLP, natural language processing, so it's going to learn how you ask questions. But if you say it's wrong, it's not going to listen to you, because maybe it's the correct legal answer, but you still can't read it, and you might say it's incorrect. So that we don't do. It works with tags. That's more for the back end, because most jurists are not great ICT specialists, so they can just put it in hashtags. Okay, you see. Get relevant document generator is also, but you have to question yourself. I don't know if how many entrepreneurs are in this room, but if you're using this robot, then you might say, Matthias, it's all very nice, these questions and answers, but I don't get real to the point. I mean, yes, you get a legal answer, but you also want the document with it. Maybe you also want some personalized advice. So that's the next step we're going to. We're going to build a marketplace, Lianali Chat, Docs, Lawyer. It will be a platform for lawyers and clients to connect, e-commerce, because if you have a webshop now, no one wants to pay 1,000 euro for legal documents anymore, so it will be like 10 euro per month to have legal docs on your webshop always updated. So that's the thing with legal tech now, it's a lot of little products. And that's a bad thing, because as an entrepreneur, as a business, but even as a consumer, you're not going to have a subscription on a chatbot and a document generator. You just want Spotify for all your music. You will want to have one product. Whether that's ours, I don't know. It will depend on further funding, but it will be one. I think that's all I really have to say. Questions?
You said before that this change was already removed from 17 to 18, 2017 to 18.
Yes.
So, what do you think if everything is AI? In the end, what is if we could reduce like the state and everything would be AI, what would this mean for this?
For lawyers or for everyone?
Yeah, just in general.
Ooh, it's a very broad question. I think it's gonna take decades before we have an AI government or anything like that, or AI will be mass adopted. I know I'm speaking about 2025, but I'm an AI optimist. A lot of people are AI pessimists. And they're talking more like 2040, 2050. We don't know. There are a lot of people making predictions out there. I think AI is a great tool. What we really have to worry about is that right now we are putting the legal and ethical questions in the hands of the big tech companies, and it's not supposed to be there. I mean, those tech companies, they are just the new oil companies. They just want profit for their shareholders. So ethics, privacy, and everything around that, it's not on their agenda. So we have to make sure the government gets up to date. But the problem is most governments, they're like, AI, machine learning, I've never heard of it. It's irrelevant. Like cryptocurrency, you know, it's difficult for classic industries, and the government is also a very classic industry to get on point of this. So I don't know. I don't want to make a prediction. Also, if you have legal questions, it's free tonight, which okay. never happens.
Short question. So I was one of the people who raised my hands and thought law was boring. But my best friend is a lawyer, and I asked her once, why be a lawyer?
She's not boring.
Her answer was that she loves the language involved in law. It's very specific, very rich, very detailed, and our values, our culture are embedded in language. Anyway, I was wondering if in your experience the NLP you're talking about, is sophisticated enough to deal with the nuance of legal language?
It's a really good question. First of all, we looked at a few systems out there. So Watson, IBM Watson, is the biggest player in AI. But Watson has no NLP for the Dutch language. So they had to make the AI engine from scratch. We called it Oswald, or the company that created it. And it's actually multilingual. It's ready for Dutch, French, and so on. But what we tried to do is convert that rich, what your friend calls it, legal language, I call it very not transparent, to convert it to normal people language, which isn't always easy to do, because if there were some people with a legal background, then you would know that every legal word has a meaning. So just converting it to speech, to normal speech, is very difficult. So yes, it is a problem. I would be lying if I said that at the moment it's rich enough to do everything, because it's not. It's a beta, it's a test phase, and we are very, very early in the market. You know, AI, the evolution is staggering, because it only needed 1 year to penetrate the legal field. It's 2017. That was the AI year for legal. But it will take many, many years to get the same understanding of the legal language as normal lawyers do. In the US, it will go much quicker than here.
We have time after both speakers to talk a bit more, but before we go to Max Hampshire, I wanted to ask one more question. If I understand what you're saying about the opportunity for AI in the legal field, is that it can automate the things that have been going on like they have been going on for 200 years.
Yeah.
At the same time, you showed us an example of this Tesla car, which actually is not something that has been going on for 200 years, but actually what you might call a legal novelty. We are kind of struggling with the legal implications of such a question. So is this an example of the field that you think will be penetrated by AI or not? Because it seems to be that for this particular question, you actually cannot use AI because it's not automated. It's actually what we need is humans for these questions.
Ooh, it's a really good question. I don't know if I'm smart enough to answer it. Are we going to use AI to solve AI legal questions? I don't
exactly.
think so.
Yeah.
It will take, maybe that's the interesting answer for this. It won't take just lawyers or legal people. It will take philosophers, philosophical people. It will take scientists. It will take ethical people and so on. So thinking that just lawyers can draft up the new regulation around AI, that's a big mistake. You will have psychologists and so on. You need a multidisciplinary team to solve these tricky questions. Yeah.
And only once they are solved for a good bit, then they become automatable.
Sure, yeah. yeah. I mean, so if you do it for one car or for one ethical question, I don't see why the AI couldn't. Also, there's been in the Netherlands, there was an e-court, maybe we talk about it later.
Exactly,
so I don't want to say too much about it. But the thing that judges, real-life judges, would be replaced by AI, it scares a lot of people, and right now it should, but AI will become as smart as a human, and if you're a human judge and you say, okay, this woman was fired from her company, but she worked there 25 years, she has a marriage and whatnot, those are all things you can also integrate in AI. It's just not smart enough right now to do that.
Okay. This is the question, to what extent can we expect AI at some points to also get a sense of justice, because right now all they can do is kind of interpret executable code, which is now in language,
right now.
In form of language, and because the sense of justice, of course, we don't have it because we read the law, we get it from almost a biological existence.
Yeah. AI will have to do two things. It will be either be able what ROS does. ROS is really machine learning. In ROS, they just put every legal decision in the United States and legal law books into the machine, and the machine spits something out. Mm-hmm. But it will be a combination of that knowledge and also human interacted behavior that's been studied over years,
right,
and court decisions. If you integrate this, it will be a very powerful machine, but it will take a decade before we're there, I think.
Yeah. Later on, maybe we'll talk about the human in the loop question again. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Now, I would like to introduce now to you Max Hampshire. Concentrating on the, if I'm quoting his own bio, concentrating on unraveling the emergent politics of cryptographically enabled platforms. Also a noise artist and initiator of various noise ensembles. That's not why he's tonight.
No.
Here he is tonight. He's here as an initiator of the Terra Zero project, which I would say is one of those nearly mind-boggling legal novelties. And after Max's talk, we'll maybe see to what extent automation will actually poses us radically new questions, or actually is able to answer all our older questions.
Yep.
Max Hampshire.
Cool. Thanks for having me. I have far fewer slides than the previous talk, so I'll kind of give you a brief outline now and then just kind of ramble through it. So the project that I'm involved in, I'm one of three co-founders of Terra Zero. The other two guys, Paul Colling and Paul Seidler, couldn't be here tonight. So I'm going to give an outline of that, and then I'm going to talk more generally about what decentralized tech and applications based on decentralized substrates like blockchain, what this actually means for the legal realm as we know it, and then also what like strange new legal questions are going to throw up when we start getting these really different organizational forms and forms of economic interaction existing because of this. And then at the end, I'm going to throw like a really speculative, fun, weird, far future situation, which will at first sound like sci-fi, but then actually you realize that because all of this is happening now and we can't really stop it, this might happen at some point, so it kind of gains a bit of urgency. So Terra Zero started off originally actually as a concept piece, basically laying out the idea of how, or asking the question of how a forest could become a sovereign entity by being owned and managed by a decentralized autonomous corporation organization. So kind of giving economic agency to an ecosystem, somehow granting it the kind of agency that we usually expect from either businesses or people. And I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to, like, how much, or, like, raise your hand if you have, you would say, like, a reasonable understanding of, like, Bitcoin, Ethereum-ish, just, like, a super conceptual level. That's wicked. Don't have to explain too much now. Also, decentralized autonomous organization is, like, really hard to say quite fast, so I'm just going to call it a DAO from now on as well. So that was the kind of speculative origins of Terra Zero. And now, actually, because of how quickly all of this technology is developing, we kind of realized that the speculative situation we were kind of sketching is actually now technically feasible. So now we're actually a company which is built on the Ethereum network, and we provide like forestry resilience solutions by allowing DAOs to manage the natural assets of forested ecosystems. And basically by instantiating a DAO kind of on top of an ecosystem, and then tokenizing all of its natural assets, so representing each of the token, each of the trees by a token, we seem to say, and then giving control over these tokens and the trees that go with them to the DAO, ecosystems are actually being managed according to like a predetermined set of rules and criteria to become resilient, but also completely free from the possibilities of human mismanagement, corruption, and basically run autonomously. So these DAOs... sorry, what?
No, sorry.
Okay, cool. So these DAOs, by interacting with things like oracles, like external data sources, and, for instance, looking at the results of processed satellite images, can themselves actually then make decisions about, say, which of the trees, if any of them, could be sold for the forest as a whole to make a profit, whilst also making sure that it's not, say, overlogged, so it actually promotes this kind of resilient growth of ecosystems. And one of the things that interested us so much in this is that tokenization as a kind of form, you know, the representing of physical things in the world by a token that can be then traded digitally, actually opens up a lot of ways for an ecosystem to kind of capitalize on itself in this non-exploitative way. So you give it a kind of economic agency, but also give it the interface by which it sets out how you interact with it. So kind of it calls all of the shots. And so we're trying to bring about situations where you can start really getting kind of communities of people who live around the forest or in forests, or even just, you know, with the example of kind of larger city parks, interact with them on a daily basis, actually kind of bring about new organizational forms and new interactions between people and ecosystems, but on the same level as kind of peers. But the DAO is always kind of laying out, it always has the final say over whether something happens. So we're really kind of flattening the hierarchy between ecosystems and people by using money. And usually money is used to put up some pretty intense hierarchy. So I think it's quite nice that we're kind of transgressing that. And ultimately what we want to see happen is for lots of these DAOs to be instantiated, hopefully all over the world. And these will start sharing information amongst themselves about kind of their respective forests and the results of whatever actions that are undertaken with them. And this will kind of create a global kind of Terra Zero network, which doesn't only allow for each individual DAO to like further optimize its own performance by looking and, I suppose, learning from the data of other ecosystems, but actually as a kind of far future goal, hopefully this will become a really important bed of information for kind of environmental management groups and other administrators of natural resources. And obviously all this data hopefully can be trusted a lot more because it's being gathered in a completely like trustless environment. So what is a DAO and why does it matter here? So basically a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization which could actually be seen as a form of non-human agency which is supported or lives on a blockchain. And this idea basically isn't actually that complex. What a DAO comes about when you take the very basic idea of something like a transaction-based blockchain, like the Bitcoin blockchain, which basically you could move A to B in a completely trusted environment. No one has, no middlemen, it's fine. And you take this a step further, which is what the Ethereum network did, and you create a programmable blockchain, which in a way is kind of a global distributed computer. So you allow for the instantiation of quite a complex system of either manually executing or like self-executing bits of code, which is obviously my kind of main focus here, and as well as allowing these bits of code to own their own assets and transfer them amongst themselves as they wish. And yep, these self-executing bits of code are called smart contracts, which are basically just are instantiated on the Ethereum blockchain and perform operations. I suppose like a rough analogy would be kind of like the logic gates of a traditional computer. And this basically allows for like a customizable governance system to be facilitated in a totally trustless environment, which runs autonomously and very much could be seen as actively engaging in whatever activities it's able to do or kind of following very much its own goals, its own aims, which starts to kind of look like a very narrow form of artificial intelligence. And this brings me, in a very roundabout way, to the sort of questions that we're all kind of here today to talk about, which is this: what kind of happens when this gray area of non-human or artificial agency kind of collides with legal notions of personhood and ownership. And these questions basically come about because even like a super simple smart contract, so something that, for instance, I could upload a document to or upload a little bit of money to, and I could say, whenever a certain event is triggered, you send that money somewhere else and you send the document somewhere else, right? Super simple function. Because this sits autonomously and just waits for something to happen, in an economic sense, even this super simple smart contract could actually be seen as an agent, as like an active agent. And then when you start getting a DAO made of the kind of meshes of interacting smart contracts, so like a whole level of abstraction above this, you actually start to get things like emergent behavioral patterns kind of springing up. Again, this is like the kind of the beginnings of a very narrow, decentralized artificial intelligence. And at this point, like I said, this is one of the bits that sounds like science fiction. It sounds very speculative and far future. But it's actually important to kind of recognize that this idea of non-human agents has actually been practiced in law for an incredibly long time. And the first of these like legal fictions was the idea of a legal person, which was brought about with the advent of the corporation, as we all know and love them today. And basically what a legal person was, contra to a natural person, which all of us in here today are natural people, we're born with certain rights in virtue of the fact that we're born as a human. A legal person is a falsified legal entity that's kind of granted certain rights for a particular reason. So a corporation was classed as a legal person, so it was able to own property or sell property and be legally liable much in the same way that we are as well. And Charles Stross, who is a kind of hard science fiction author, writes a lot about this, and I would very much recommend checking out his blog, Antipope. And basically he said that these corporations, as well as being the first non-human legal persons, were also kind of the first form of very slow AI, because they were non-human entities that basically acted on admittedly quite an abstract economic level, autonomously and completely in their own self-interest. And what I mean by self-interest here is that a corporation has one goal, which is surviving. And how does a corporation survive? It makes money. So they're kind of an economic, non-human legal person that basically metabolizes and lives off capital. And that's the only goal of a corporation. And now if we start talking about decentralized autonomous organizations or corporations, things start getting really weird, because in the case of any technology which kind of runs decentralized on a blockchain, which we all know, it's, you know, we have the problem of immutability and the problem of decentralization when we're talking about trying to get one of them to stop doing a particular thing. That's the whole point of them. And so shutting one of these down is phenomenally difficult if we actually start thinking about it in kind of pragmatic terms. You know, if a normal corporation like Facebook or Amazon, one of the global supergiants, suddenly everyone starts legislating against some of their actions, you can shut down, you know, a battery of server farms and it's done. But if you had a decentralized Amazon, you'd have to find all of the computers that were running that node and physically turn them off, which is obviously like a whole different kettle of fish. And on top of this, we have an industry centered around these kind of decentralized technological substrates, which is worth like tens of billions of dollars and has come about in maybe, what, the last decade, half decade? And there is also an incredible amount of effort going into actually developing blockchain infrastructure and applications. Like my, I suppose, like day job is actually working in Rotterdam for BlockLab, which is industrial blockchain solutions, and blockchain infrastructure is spreading kind of everywhere. So give it another 5 or 10 years, and most things will be running to an extent decentralized, which really kind of grants urgency. hopefully, to what I'm saying. And as soon as we then combine this with AI, things get even weirder. So there is a fantastic... So there's a great series of Medium posts by a, I suppose, AI theorist and blockchain innovator called Trent McConaughey that I would really recommend checking out. And his idea is that it's not impossible to imagine these things, these DAOs, actually becoming a little bit more intelligent than what they already are, which is these kind of goal-seeking, constantly capitalizing entities. And actually doing something like making money by utilizing a simple, for instance, machine learning program, like the Google DeepMind program, which, you know, it made pleasant, trippy pictures. So you program a DAO to do this, and, you know, you interact with it. It creates one for you. You give it a bit of money. It gets better at what it's doing. And then say you program one of these DAOs to, after they've earned a certain amount of money, copy their own code, or even scrape GitHub and add little extra functions to their own code, and kind of reproduce. And they give this child DAO a little bit of their excess money and send it off into the wild as well. And suddenly you have two of them doing different things with the sole purpose of making money. And, you know, even from Tay, the chatbot, we know that humans interacting with things on the internet can go, like, really wrong. But this is like a Tay you couldn't show off. And before you know it, you kind of have like a network of these autonomous agents holding money, making money, with the sole task of making money in the most efficient way, which aren't controllable or even necessarily able to be traced back to an individual person. So we're talking about code that, for all intents and purposes, owns itself. You know, the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of one of these DAOs could have been a random bit of GitHub code that was actually pulled from somewhere else completely. Like, you know, it's... So we're now talking about self-ownership at the code level, which is very strange, and we're talking about ownership at the level of capital by autonomous entities. And, yeah, basically, this is possibly going to be very problematic. It's also very cool. And so what now for the kind of... To bring it back to... I suppose, the legal talk. What now for the near future? And I think one of the things we need to do to be even able to start talking about this properly, and for it to sound less like a slightly speculative sci-fi discussion, is to actually open up our conceptions of these really basic things like ownership, to incorporate non-humans into them. And these are very different relations of things like ownership and personhood than we're now used to as well. You know, this is my e-reader. Whose is the 17th generational GitHub code that's a tiny part of a DAO? Don't know. And we need to do this because even though this idea of the legal person has actually been around for a while, and there's a lot of hype when it comes to both blockchain tech and AI of people saying this is completely new when actually it's not. It's just doing something in a different way. In this instance, the hype, I suppose, is real because corporations were made legal persons to basically just help those in corporations and nothing more. A corporation became a legal entity, so all of the people within it weren't necessarily legally liable. If something massive happened, you know, one of the biggest infrastructure projects in the US, which was the building of the railroads, was accomplished by a corporation because none of the very small fragmented groups who were also building railroads wanted to take on that task because if they failed, they would be liable and it was just too great a risk. And there are also other examples of things like natural areas being made legal persons so they could be granted legal protection by kind of allowing humans to act as a proxy for them in a courtroom. So, and kind of things like this. And there's also talk at the moment going around the European Council, which is of talking of robots as electronic persons. But basically this, when you actually cut through the hype, is just talking about how can you tax something that's supposedly autonomous. Whereas with the kind of situations that could come about in these relatively far future developments, there's a lot of technical issues holding back this kind of interaction of artificial intelligence and anything on a blockchain, because they're very slow at the moment. But they are getting a lot better, so we need to talk about it. If we look at this kind of like speculative, broader notion of non-human agency and combine it with the fact that even if you legislate against the existence of a DAO, if it's already running, there's very little you can do to stop it. We kind of like really get the sense that we're possibly playing around with quite powerful things, or not playing around, we're letting them loose. We're talking about potentially whole industries where everything down to like the code that actually makes up the entities themselves isn't able to be directly linked back to a person or a group of people, which in and of itself is a bizarre notion for, especially in the West, where everything, even down to the level of the ground, has an owner. And kind of using Terra Zero as an example, we're talking about the possibility of areas of land or even whole ecosystems which are managed and owned by a mesh of DAOs. And obviously in the case of Terra Zero, we're trying to be one of the good DAOs, you know? These are going to be kind of environmental resilience optimizers in order to make money. But as I kind of said before, there's obviously the space for stuff to just start going wrong or just spin out in a way that we can't even really predict yet. And the possibility that these systems could spin out of control and possibly even take control over huge swathes of the economy before anyone notices what's going on is actually linked, I suppose. I want to kind of draw an analogy between that and kind of what's known as this dystopian grey goo situation, which usually comes about when you discuss nanobots. Is anyone like aware of what this is? A couple of nods, so I'll explain it. So basically, this is kind of a speculative situation where self-reproducing nanobots are basically programmed to do something good, like dissolve the harmful plastic in the Earth's oceans. And in doing so, they produce energy, they reproduce to make more of these nanobots, and the excess waste that's left behind is a little bit of grey goo, right? But then if you say something like one of them glitches and starts reproducing and actually starts classing all the matter that isn't itself as plastic, so it just starts devouring all the matter down on the nano, like the nanoscopic level, and reproducing more of itself using this energy, suddenly you have this kind of end of the world situation where, because of this technical glitch, everything is just turned into a pile of grey goo by nanobots that were basically doing their job, or what they thought was their job, what they were programmed to do, their one goal. And something that is alluded to by Trent, but something that I want to bring up here, is that... Sorry? Oh, cool. No worries. I thought you said I was going too fast. Like, it's cool. And I suppose this is a kind of like economic analog of that. If you suddenly have huge swathes of the information economy, or even the kind of monetary economy, crypto or otherwise, being controlled by entities that are basically doing what they are trying to do to survive, which is make more money and do their thing, with no, I suppose, need, or even they're removed from the notion of good and bad, then we could kind of have an economic analog of this nanobot grey goo situation on our hands. And I think what is most pervasive about these new notions of non-human but legal ownership is the fact they exist on totally different levels than we're used to talking about. And there are lots of different potential areas in which kind of non-human ownership can exist. And I want to run through like just three of them now. And one thing I want to say is that actually, as opposed to being mutually exclusive, all of these things in the case of DAOs kind of mutually reinforce each other, and they make this system even more impervious to trying to get a DAO to do what it doesn't want to do. in the case of a tokenized natural asset, in a way, what you actually have existing between a token, and this is left over from a technical talk, we are actually using the Ethereum compliant 721 token, but like I won't explain that now, is we're talking an ownership relation that's supported by the blockchain, so it doesn't need any kind of official sanction. And whilst the token itself isn't actually able to make, you know, decisions, it's a token, it could actually be said to dictate the kind of possible actions that can be taken with the tree, with this physical thing. Because it can only be passed on, for instance, once a certain set of criteria have been fulfilled. You know, you can program these things yourself. That's the beauty of open source. And so in this sense, the actual ownership on the blockchain lays out a set of, you know, these prerequisites for token transfer, much in the same way as me only giving you something if you pay me does. You know, it's the same, like the actual mechanics of token transferal, which if you have token transferal, you have the transferal of the microphone from me to you, basically operate in the same manner as ownership transferal, as we're used to it operating on the human level. Which at first sounds quite weird, but then actually, hopefully when you start talking about it, it makes more sense. And then moving up to the next level of abstraction, we kind of have to think of, okay, as I said before, it's open source. Anyone can program any actions into a token. So we have to think of who or what is either in control over programming these parameters, or the, you know, kind of saying whether those things have been met. And whilst there aren't actually any instances of like self-mutating Ethereum programs just yet, they aren't at all like beyond the realm of possibility. I think it's just because no one's tried to do them yet. And so, say if one of the Terra Zero DAOs is located in a particularly hostile environment, say it's in a desert, or somewhere that has just suffered some kind of dramatic loss in biomass, and thus rarely, if ever, actually sells off any of its natural assets. This is basically tantamount to like hoarding assets, much in the same way that I could hoard something in a bank account or physically hoard things, in a way that aside from stealing it from me, again, it's completely inaccessible to any other agent within this kind of economic circuit. And then, say we also add a function where if you steal from a DAO, it pays for a human proxy to represent itself in court. So we have a completely technically feasible, if very far off, scenario where a DAO is actually just as able to defend its property in the legal realm as any natural person is, and is actually able to hold its own property in a far more secure way than any human being is as well. You know, the cryptographic protections that have actually facilitated the birth of blockchain technology kind of come to the forefront here because, you know, as we all know, there's no way of brute forcing a wallet that's properly secured. Whereas you can definitely brute force a house or, you know, whatever, the password to my co-op bank account. But you can't brute force an Ethereum wallet. So actually, we now have a possible situation whereby the most secure way of holding funds is actually by non-human entities and in this kind of non-human ownership. Yeah, so I kind of want to bring this to like a roundabout conclusion where basically this far future speculative scenario is only held back from the near future one because of the current like nitty-gritty technical problems. But given how much the world has changed in the past 5 years with the advent of all of these and the increasing amount of funding that's going into, you know, private companies, infrastructure companies, groups like Consensus, and even just the efforts of the open source community themselves, we are kind of accelerating towards a point whereby these things will no longer be technically impossible. And so we kind of have to start thinking about these really bizarre, abstract legal issues now, because they are kind of going to sneak up on us. So we might as well start talking about them now so we can hopefully try to start dealing with them. And yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much, Max. That was
Yeah, mind-boggling would be appropriate. Yeah. Does anybody have an immediate question? Sorry, please speak in the microphone.
One of the setbacks of Bitcoin is the huge amount of energy they use, and you present your project as something that's very sustainable. So how do you go about that? I mean, does it take a lot of energy to operate these machines?
Yeah, I mean, what actually takes? I mean, the thing that actually takes so much energy with Bitcoin is the security protocol itself, which is proof of work. However, there are lots of other protocols around there, such as proof of stake or proof of authority, which don't actually require this like massive amount of computing power. So that's the hugely environmentally damaging, or like the massive energy cost of a lot of the security of the Bitcoin blockchain is just because of how they do it. It's not something that's kind of endemic to blockchains themselves.
And also, you might bring up the Harvest project, Max. If you tie that one in. Yeah, there's Julian Oliver, who's actually speaker of the Bot Club before, who uses a wind machine to harvest energy, sells the energy for a cryptocurrency, which is then used to fund climate research.
If you tie
this one in, and you're solved.
Yeah, there are actually there are a couple of mining farms that also run off wind power as well, which is kind of cool.
Can I ask, Matthias, would you allow me to ask me the question? To what extent do you think this is plausible?
Do you want me to sit here or stand up?
Please, yeah.
Sit together.
Yeah.
More fun, no?
Yeah. We didn't really plan a panel, but.
I saw chairs.
I know, yes. You're very right. You're very right. Yeah. Like to what extent does this sound
very lazy?
Yeah. Plausible. The legal theory side. I mean, I'm by no means a legal expert. You're a legal expert, but not an expert on the blockchain yet. Yeah. But you know about legal personhood.
Yeah. Obviously. I mean, I studied the blockchain. The whole theory about it, but if you explain it to most legal persons, and that was already when I studied IT, 99% of lawyers have no idea what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a backend. If I'm talking about blockchain, they're totally losing it. So the big problem I think you are going to have is the government, because if you give that same speech to our Belgian government, maybe in the Netherlands it's better, but they will be completely lost.
Yeah.
About the natural personhood, sure. I mean, it was a question from a journalist in Belgium too a few months ago, because in Dubai they gave a robot national status.
Yeah,
she could talk. I forgot
Sophia.
The name. Sophia. That's it. And he asked me, "How is this possible?" I said, "Just look at a company or a VZW vereniging. I mean, they're not real persons either. So it's perfectly your model is perfectly possible." It's a bit scary, though, because what you've been saying, you're obviously much more intelligent than me, but it's a bit scary.
We're scared of it as well.
Certainly because we just lose
control. If you're not
scared,
you didn't pay attention.
Yeah, like I said, it started off as a concept project, and then the full magnitude of what it possibly could be follows. Yeah.
Control that we lose. You know, we are controlling these legal persons, these companies. We can control from A to Z. But what you're talking about is possibly uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And that's what people don't like.
Mm. So can I ask a technical, are there only any other blockchain experts in the hall as well?
Yeah.
Or more or less? No, not really. Okay. To what extent, because it seems to be that the blockchain is developed as this, brute forceable technology. At the same time, the fact that you would have to kind of shut down all the individual computers on which it runs, to what extent do you think that is itself automatable? I mean, could, maybe this is a highly speculative question, but I can imagine, somebody will start thinking, we should find a way to automatically shut down blockchains.
Yeah, definitely, kind of building in a backdoor to all the computers that are now made that...
Yeah,
if you want to kill it, you can't.
Or run them on a virtual, example, whatever.
I mean, it's completely possible. You know, with the the kind of OPSEC nightmare that has come out of everything, especially that was, you know, like the cypherpunks were talking about this, but then obviously it was like brought into the public eye with WikiLeaks and all of that. Yeah, I mean, it's completely possible that this kind of could be happening. It's not that much more of a step than the kind of surveillance programs that you already know exist.
Right.
It's just a different kind of switch.
Yeah. So, but that kind of kills your, the nightmare is, well, it replaces it by another nightmare, put it
that
way. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, not kill. So, but, I mean, somehow, why is that not a factor in your story yet? Don't mean the other nightmare, but the fact that once we can automate these processes, we can also automate their... It's like spam bots, actually another Charles Trost scenario, the spamularity, the spam bot and the spam filter generating, in an arms race, generating artificial intelligence. But
I suppose it doesn't factor in my story either because that's kind of pretty grim end state dystopianism that we're talking about where like the government has the ability to not even pass data, but like just switch, or like just kill your computer. And I suppose because there's nothing I can like massively do about it. Like Terra Zero is very much coming, even in the more like speculative stages, that can be kind of, you can trace those thoughts back to a practical action that can, like that could or could not be taken now. You know,
right.
With the kind of with the embryonic status of this tech. I don't really want to think about kill switches in everyone's computers.
Yeah.
But also, that's a whole different level of engineering.
Yeah. Can we maybe go back to the this question here? Also, had another question about the legal person in the DAO context. But Shiloh had a question. Yeah.
So it's interesting how you say there's this way you can't break into the, say, the cryptographically secured network of a blockchain. But of course, what you can, or you could.
I mean, what I meant specifically, like, the wallet where funds are stored.
But of course, what you do have, then, it's, of course, a proxy for the physical thing. That it's a token for say, a tree in your case.
Yeah.
Someone can still take a chainsaw to the tree, whether or not the blockchain allows for it.
No, totally.
How do you prevent that kind of sabotage?
Well, I mean, are we talking on a kind of a more abstract level when we're talking about the relationship between tokens and the natural assets that they link, or with Terra Zero specifically? Because there's kind of two like tangents I can go down there.
I guess it's a matter of principle, but it comes up. It's very clear in your project as an example.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing is, just for example, entire networks would fail because of energy failure.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a tremendous loss of value. Yet there are still things in the world.
Yeah.
So this digital physical issue, but I guess it comes out very concretely in the forests example.
Yeah. I mean, with this kind of on the more abstract level, this link between the natural asset and the token that represents it, this kind of like digital twin thing, is a massive problem. Because then you have to have another accountability mechanism somewhere in there. You know, how do we make sure that the two are actually still twinned? And then that kind of becomes a middleman again, and then all you've done is just make a really expensive, slow version of what you've already got, right? But then actually what's kind of happening with that is that you need to kind of deal with it on an almost ad hoc basis. So with the instance of Terra Zero, I mean, you know, I spoke about the kind of speculative thing where as a site monitors itself and realizes someone's illegally logged a couple of the trees, it could, I don't know, pay for a proxy human to go to court for it, something like that. So it's got basically, it's got the same level of protection as if I just grew particularly, I don't know, I grew eucalyptus trees or something, and someone stole a load of them, and I wasn't able to sell them. You know, it's the same.
But at the same time, the person, this is the essence of my question. If I go into that forest, you know, fell down a number of trees, and just say, these are my trees. How would you contest that?
The same way I would otherwise.
Would today.
There's no... the claim isn't being made that because a token represents them, the trees are impervious to any kind of illegal physical action that could also be taken if I owned the land, as you know, I own the land as opposed to giving it to a DAO. And I mean, I think this is a different question from the notion of tokenization, because this is kind of like security in a very different way.
Just build a fence, basically,
yeah.
Or make it grow poisonous weeds. Yeah.
I mean, the digital does not really interface with the physical, which is one of the beautiful things about tokenization, but then you also can't forget about the physical. Yeah, if you really want to protect something, you still need to put it in a box somewhere.
So basically what you're saying, the answer is the same question. This is the same way we do it today,
yeah.
Without the DAO. That's the answer. Can I go back to legal personhood? Because I was fascinated. Again, the car also poses an interesting example.
Yeah.
Because the corporation represents the car, but the natural person is always an individual.
Yes.
So in your example, if I'm correct,
yeah.
That this artificial corporation-like DAOs, and if they instantiate themselves, they are no longer... I mean, to what extent is the notion of the individual still hold, or is that exactly one of the problems you mean, that disappears?
I mean, it really...
It's also a question to...
I mean, the difficulty of talking about this is, one, I don't have an academic legal background. Mm-hmm. Two, there is not really that much... There is nothing really written about this.
Right. Yeah,
these are like weird fringe questions that are popping up.
Yeah.
Who knows, in 5 years, maybe someone will write a particular piece of, juridical text and everything will be fine. But I think...
No, but it's the accountability question.
Yeah, no, I mean...
Like if you stick it to the car, then it maybe gets clearer.
Because
is it Tesla? Is it the lawyers of Tesla? Is it the insurance company? Is it the code builders of Tesla?
Yeah.
Who are the accountable?
I suppose in the case of an autonomous car and... Mike Hearn has talked about these quite a lot, like going further than Tesla.
Sure.
Of actually this we took some quite a lot of influence from Mike Hearn talking about autonomous vehicles. Actually, you know, owning themselves, paying for their own repairs and gas and whatever, and having wallets and all of this kind of stuff. And these questions get really interesting because there has to be a certain edge of like practical. Like realism involved as well.
But can I ask a question to Matthias also, who is the legal expert?
Yeah, please do.
I could listen to you all night. I think you have such a philosophical view of things. You know, this is exactly why I said that lawyers or legal people alone, they cannot solve the question. I'm not quite sure after you talk for hours to them that they will actually understand, but it's those philosophical questions are good to ask, of course. In the legal sphere, it's... For now, as the situation exists for now, Tesla has, and also Apple Car and whatever company has said, if we run someone over or we crash into a school, all the costs are ours. Because, of course, it's the company that drives it. The same for legal bots. If there's a mistake and you depend your million-dollar case on AI legal advice, the AI company that produces it will be liable because... No one is talking... Yes, it's not true. Some people are talking about giving legal status to AI. In the United Kingdom, they did the exercise and they said, no, we are not going to give a legal status to robots or AI. Mm-hmm. The European...
Why not?
Because they don't believe that it is necessary at this time. They think that with the standard concept of a company, so also that illusion of a legal person, it will be enough. They don't believe that robots at this phase need to have a separate state. Yeah. Some do. Yeah. And the European Commission is still not quite sure because they're too busy building in a Terminator switch on the physical robots that are coming to kill us all.
Yeah.
So the legal answer is really simple. Right now, there is no understanding on the superior level of AI because they think it's really Terminator. And thanks to the sci-fi movies, but it's a bit sad.
Yeah. I suppose like it's It's also quite an interesting question in and of itself to try and apply the notion of accountability to, you know, a DAO mm-hmm. that controls a forest. Mm-hmm. Like, it's to a certain extent anthropocentrizing it, which...
Right. Yeah, but that's what accountability is all about.
No, but that's what that's what I mean. Like, whether it's even it's even something we can talk about as well. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously you could build a friendly DAO that, you know, you could make a claim that like something went wrong and it'd be like, oh, sorry, and it would pay you off.
Yeah. Oh, but but, sorry, there's a question there.
I don't want to go into this conversation too much, but what I really liked about Matthias' talk is that, for my non-expert mind, it makes law easier to understand. That was a point in your talk. Law is very difficult to understand. It's a lot of jargon, and it makes it easier to understand. But what I hear from you, Max, correct me if I'm wrong, but the notion of the blockchain in this legal sort of field is going to make things much more complicated at the start. Much more confusing at the start, and I'm wondering to what extent can blockchain make this field of all these legal questions easier and less complex? Is there opportunities to make it
there are definitely opportunities, if not necessarily to make, I mean, to a certain extent, yes, actually there's an organization called Materium, which is Vinay Gupta is one of the people who is co-running it, and they're basically setting up identity management system on the blockchain, and like the actual like nitty gritty bits of identity management it costs an incredible amount of money. If there's a mistake, you have two kind of huge companies fighting out over who's wrong and who's right, and it takes forever, and the poor person who like literally just wanted to, I don't know, get a loan is stuck in this limbo like forever, right? And he's actually working on a platform where through the blockchain you actually create a kind of like a self-sovereign identity. So for all of my medical records, say I go to my doctor, who is the person who knows what all that stuff is, and then I get an attestment from them, which sits, you know, on the blockchain, saying this person has X, Y, and Z, otherwise they're perfectly healthy, right? So then any time I have to go somewhere else and prove my identity, what I actually have is a completely secure thing signed by a medical professional, so it's completely trusted by this other person, and then they just have to look at the fact that that exists. They don't have to look through all of the mess of it, and they say, okay, cool. And say if you start doing this with kind of every other form of identity you've got, not only does it practically actually like streamline the process of getting anything done, but actually it removes a lot of the kind of the messy edge cases where people get things wrong. But third, it also removes quite a lot of the nasty, gnarly stuff where you have huge, like you're spreading your personal data around because you have to, whereas in this instance, you just have this kind of attestation from someone who's trusted that this is true without having to give all of your personal data about, you know, your medical records and where you've previously lived and stuff to your bank. So there are definitely efforts which are like streamlining these processes, but it's at the same time, it's throwing up a whole host of messes as well.
I think also what counts in is that the adoption of blockchain and crypto. Is anyone owning crypto? Anyone has a crypto wallet here? See, it's like 3-4 people I also own. Like 5 or 6 different coins. And, you know, it's the market cap. The total market cap for crypto is 1/3 of Amazon stock value. So it's basically nothing right now. I think when, and it's also very theoretically, what you're saying is it's very theoretical. I know it exists in real, but it will take a it will take some time, and it will only come with a mass adoption that everyone will start to understand. Will it make it more complex, the law in itself? I think the first years, yes, because we're going to have to start thinking about cars driving you over, about legal persons, like we addressed already.
Yeah.
But then once we settle on this and there's a mass adoption and everyone is paying one dash to another, or you're trading in Litecoin or whatever, or it's really a big flop. And then I lost all my money and a few people here also, because Bitcoin reached 10K today. When that is coming, the mass adoption, then it's going to be more easy, I think. It's going to be very easy to understand, because blockchain, in essence, is just a way of proving something that is that is there. I mean, it's almost a non-breachable way of proof, blockchain.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of like briefly follow up on that situation, I think a lot of the pure cryptocurrency stuff that's knocking about, I think a lot of that is a hype cycle. Mm-hmm. It is a bubble. It's going to burst. And I actually think that quite a lot of the kind of the messy legal stuff that's going on behind the scenes will actually not necessarily affect a lot of people outside of industries which are already messy. Like I kind of think that the way that blockchain tech will slowly move to mass adoption is in a similar way that most technology does, which is that it slowly seeps into the infrastructure, like of, you know, companies, very, very basic infrastructures like power or something like that, and is never really kind of user-facing until 20 or 30 or 40 years down the line, after which the law will have been streamlined both by like common law and then just common practice as well. So I think for the kind of individuals, I can't see it being this kind of creator of even more legal chaos, if that also answers your question.
Yes, she was first.
You're a crypto pessimist.
Thanks. I think kind of piggybacking off of what you just finished saying, Max, is this idea, well, we keep coming up with the idea of like accountability and legitimacy, I guess. And Matthias, you started out at the very beginning of your talk talking about like the role of law, and you bring up like, oh, you need it in your everyday, like for consent, but sexual consent. But the idea of sexual consent is kind of a joke, like for most of history, as long as there's been marriage, because if you were in a marriage agreement, then there was no need for sexual consent. So I think that like there's this sort of development of, you have technological advancement, which therefore has like a window of time before government or legal nation states like play catch up and see where it can be taken advantage of. And on the in-between, there's social progress or social development, and that adapts into where it can be taken advantage of for the nation state.
It's interesting.
Just recap. Okay, so I guess I'm a little bit more curious about how we can use this idea of legitimacy to rethink the idea of who is the legal agent that we're trying to secure or protect, and how can this kind of technology, which clearly can be out of a nation state, or this idea of consumer as, or sort of clients as customer, and beings or agents, non-human, human, within something outside of this format that seems to be outdated of the nation state. Mm-hmm. So territory and legitimate agent and the role of accountability.
Do you want to go first? Or like?
Well, fairly big question also.
You go first.
Okay. Cool. There's a lot of places I could go with that.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm gonna like focus on, because I think one of the things that I think is,
we have 5 more minutes.
All right, concise.
Yeah.
So basically,
we have even 2 more questions possible. Also.
Yeah.
So yes or no?
Yeah. So, I mean, yes.
Okay. Yeah, done.
Firm yes. No, I think what's actually very interesting when you look at a blockchain, which is basically just a list of mass consensus about a series of events that have happened, right? So in a very reductive sense, what was accepted into the next block is the truth. And that is what truth equates to on a blockchain. And it is a series of events. And so in a way, actually, it kind of either circumvents or reduces those kinds of complex issues down to a simple yes or no, did X occur, and if so, when. So on a kind of higher conceptual level, actually, I think blockchains and trying to apply them in this case could actually get a bit more messy, because although obviously, like you said, circumventing the notion of bending the truth slowly over time before bringing something into law in order to help a load of people is, or like to help the nation state or a nation state, is very damaging. And there is to an extent a certain security, but there is a certain danger as well in the fact that changing the protocol of what is accepted or why something is accepted into a block, so why an event is said to have happened or not with a blockchain, is very difficult. So in a certain way, they're actually these kind of slow-moving dinosaurs in terms of what they want to accept as truth. Maybe even less so than a nation state, even though they could be used both positively and negatively. They might not be that reactive to change in that instance, but they will also never stop logging something as happening and something as not. So I suppose in a really abstract way, I'm going to pass it on to Mateus, who will hopefully answer the question.
Coming back to your question, it's really interesting that you talk about the history of the sexual consentment, because that's something that the law always does and always will do. It's catching up. It's always a story of catching up, and you're already here, but you're 10, 15 years early for the law. So I think it will take a long time for the law to catch up, and you're already seeing it right now. You see major banks banning crypto. You see China trying to regulate crypto, it's the fourth time they banned it. They're trying to ban exchanges. So the law always plays hiccup, and what the law certainly does in the beginning of phase, they will fight back innovation. And they also fought back the liberty of women, you know, in all sense, in every sense of the word. Why? Because it's controlled by men, and imagine liberties for women. So that took a long time, and the same thing will happen because the stakeholders in our government are not the innovators. They are not the forest blockchain. No, they are the big corporations with a lot of lobby, and it will take a long, long time for your philosophical project will become reality, I'm afraid, or granted by law. That's something else.
Hi, thanks for your talks. My question is to you, Max, and maybe it's a wrong question to even ask, but can a forest be forked?
So basically what you're asking is, can you fork a tree?
Yeah.
No, it's just, sorry, this made me laugh because that was a joke that, like, actually within Terra Zero we've had. It's like just this stupid thing for a while. Can a forest be forked? I mean, sorry, this is being recorded.
Maybe this is a bar question, eh? I mean, talking.
Maybe that's a question not for 2 minutes before the end of a talk, because I need to think about that, but it's fun.
No, we can talk, we can answer this question, but not here, but down at the bar.
I mean, you could have a DAO that reproduces, and then one of them decides to follow a hard fork, and one of them decides. So, yeah, you have an Ethereum Classic DAO, and you have a post the DAO DAO. You know, after one of them's got enough money and reproduced, and one of its children goes one way and that one the other way. So I suppose actually this notion of DAOs like reproducing by copying themselves, kind of, they're just like cells, really. That is forking.
Yeah.
Like the way a DAO reproduces, it forks itself.
Two more questions, then we really have to close it off. Yeah. There was, yeah. Yeah, yeah, dan een paar vragen. Sorry. Yeah. Christina.
Actually, this is a question for Matthijs, and I actually think it's interesting that you identify this problem of the legal system being a highly bureaucratic system and very hard to understand, but at the same time, the solution that you propose is another highly bureaucratic system, which is an AI, that, in my opinion, I think it solidifies and actually makes it even make some rule decision-making procedures even more obscure to follow and understand. And I'm curious how you see the juxtapositions of these two quite intricate ways of decision-making as being something that, in the end, simplifies it.
That's a really interesting question. I already had it before. That is the danger, both the strength and the danger of something called artificial intelligence. There's a lot called AI right now. Basically, AI is very stupid. I already said it. So, but in 10 years' time, your question will become very, very relevant. If we have AI courts, when AI starts to think for itself, that will be the problem. Because for now, AI is nothing more than what researchers, philosophical people, socialists put inside the machine. So it's their principle, their ethics, their values. It actually shows that you already have AI hiring processes. it can also be discriminate based on gender, age, racial. It's sometimes more discriminating than a real employer. So I'm not quite sure that AI will solve the bureaucracy question. It will, however, solve the difficulty to access justice. It's very expensive. The rule of thumb is if anything under €1,000, don't go to court because you will lose more to the lawyer and to the court proceedings. Plus, it's a real matrix. I don't know if you're unlucky enough or you were unlucky enough to enter a court proceeding, but for most people, it's like entering the matrix and they are Neo and everything is new and they don't know what's happening. I hope with AI, not the e-court, what was in the Netherlands 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago in the news, but with better initiatives, I hope that will solve the access and transparency of justice. Will it become less bureaucratic? It's not up to me to say. I think when AI starts thinking, I think it will make more logical and obvious choices than humans can or lobbyists can.
Could I add a little bit onto that?
Sure. Though?
Because the more I mean, not even the more complex.
And then one more question.
Okay, a lot of machine learning programs, as they currently are now to an extent like black boxes. You know, in terms of the actual computation that is happening. It is a black box. So actually, it's become so complex, it's become opaque. And I mean, yeah, that simplifies it because you don't have to worry about it because no one actually knows why it's doing what it's doing. It's just doing it, and we think it's doing it well. But also, do you not see this kind of almost Kafka-esque situation where how do you fight against the judgment of some kind of machine learning based? By yay or nay? Or
by do you hiring not? A more expensive machine.
By hiring a more expensive AI. Machine.
That's the problem with the whole
it's
world.
It's the same as you do it now, in a way.
Just hiring a more expensive lawyer or a better one, it will come to a future where machines will be fighting our lawsuits. That I'm very sure of. Or we just go back to the 1950s and we say all this technology, fuck off. It's either one of the two. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if I'm a tech enthusiastic. But tech pessimists, they also have reasons to believe that we're not necessarily improving our lifestyle so much. I mean, just look at our addiction to Black Mirror. The series is also called because it's Black Mirror. And we're constantly looking at our screens. So, if anyone watches Black Mirror, we know the possible outcomes of AI. So I'm optimistic, but not to an extent that, hey, let's put everything into AI.
It's not techno-utopianism.
One last question. So we have time. What we call the critical table will be opened after our talk here downstairs at the bar, and we can continue discussing there. But since we promised to end at 9 and it's already kind of 9:15, I feel obliged to kind of close off this session here and then move downstairs. So this is your chance to ask the last question.
Thank you. My question comes from a communication background, specifically visual communication. And to follow up from what we were just mentioning with AIs, the problem with the black box, my questions to both of you, maybe you might both be able to answer it. Do you think that a solution where AIs are almost required to be accountable in the sense that they can always explain whatever they're doing, regardless of what it is that they're doing, do you think that is something that could possibly change the direction that AIs are being built right now, or something that from the legal perspective, for example, could be implemented in the future in terms of how people accept AI into different processes, whether it's a visual explanation or being able to verbose. Do you see where my question is coming from? Yeah.
To me, I think it's necessary to win the trust of the masses. Because, we've all seen the Terminator series and stuff. And I think people really distrust AI. Even companies. So I don't know how technically feasible it will be because AI will do calculations at a rate that a human or even 10 machines or 100 machines can't do. So if you want it to spit out every command it's doing, it will probably spit it out in computer code, and then there will be a transformer between the computer code and then the real language because not everyone can see computer code, and then you will just see a whole new novel every day of your AI machine. You're like, oh, what is it doing? So it is possible, but from a technical point of view, it will depend how advanced the AI is to me, but...
Yeah. As Kermit Angwin, I'm going to take up the techno-pessimist mantle that was just handed to me. And no, like, in short, I don't think it is really feasibly possible. Because quite a lot of the kind of, like I said before, quite a lot of machine learning programs now, they have become black boxes. They are, like, analytically incomprehensible to human beings.
Yeah, there's the thing, Google, where there was invented its own language.
Yeah,
was
a, and yeah, so then, Facebook bots also. Yeah, so then now, yeah. You know, and
talking
so
to each other.
What you're essentially asking like a process to be reproduced in human language, right? But one of the reasons, apart from computational speed, that we use stuff like, you know, recursive neural nets is because they are not human minds. To do something, you know? So I think apart from the sheer complexity, I don't know whether that would actually be feasibly possible. I think it'd be really interesting to try and somehow work out an interface whereby some kind of deep learning program is like attempting to visually represent the processes that it went through to get from A to B, but I don't know whether that would be possible in the way that you're talking.
I think you need at least two separate ones.
Yeah,
one
you need another
process,
AI.
The
you
other
could
one explaining
kind of like,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you'd need like a series of programs here. But yeah, so
it's
I don't.
Good question. Though.
Yeah,
way more stuff to talk about. Thank you very much, Matthias and Max.
It's a pleasure.
Who's it? Yeah, let's give them. Right now, I would like all of you to invite all of you to go downstairs and keep this discussion going for a little bit if you feel like it, and at least have a drink. Thank you very much. Yeah.